Welcome to Sermons from First Presbyterian Church, Palo Alto. Each week, we share a recording of the Sunday sermon, offering theologically progressive, social justice-oriented reflections grounded in Scripture and what's happening in our lives and in the world. Most weeks, the sermon is preached by our pastor, the Reverend Tom Harris, and from time to time, we're joined by guest preachers. The following sermon is from the 10 a.m. service on Sunday, March 22nd, 2026. It is based on John chapter 6, verse 51 through 61. It is one of the more difficult passages in the Gospel of John in which Jesus calls on his followers to eat his flesh and drink his blood. Reverend Harris talks about the human disgust response and how it can be weaponized against marginalized groups. He also looks at the symbolism behind Jesus' teaching and the purpose of metaphor in erasing the lines that too often divide us from one another.
You got help. Oh, there's so many things in there that we should talk about, but I just want to talk about one. But let's start with some assumptions that I know many of you know I bring to the Gospel of John, but I think it's worth repeating, especially since there are new folks in the congregation today. The Gospel of John is not intended to be a factual account of the life and sayings of Jesus. Instead, it is John's early Christian community trying to communicate to us their lived experience of Christ through story and through fictional dialogues and monologues, keeping in mind that good fiction can be based on true events, that it can be filled with insight and truth and wisdom and inspiration, and that it can be prophetic. And the monologues of Jesus in particular, and in the Gospel of John, there are several long monologues of Jesus that don't appear in any of the other Gospels, and we are reading from a portion of one of those monologues this morning. The monologues are John's early Christian community saying, if our experience of Christ manifests through our love of one another could talk, this is what we think it would say. So with those assumptions in mind, the question for me in this text is, why did the author or authors push this language of eating flesh and drinking blood so far? They could have said something much softer. They could have said, had Jesus say, practicing love every day is like the way we eat every day. We take food into our bodies and it becomes part of us. And so when we practice love, it becomes part of us. But instead, the author of John has Jesus say, whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life. Or John could have had Jesus say, whoever demonstrates faith by how they live and how they care for others is unified with me, the way food and drink become part of our bodies. But instead, they have Jesus say, whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood remains in me and I in them. Why does the author of John push that metaphor so far in a way that John even tells us causes people to stop following Jesus? Why does John push the metaphor so far that we aren't entirely sure he's still being metaphorical? So let's start with the fact that the metaphor itself is disgusting. Eat my flesh and drink my blood. John could have chosen a different metaphor. Maybe Jesus could have said, I am a river. Dive into me and let me guide your path. Or, I am the air you breathe. Draw me into you and let me give you life. But John instead goes with cannibalism. One explanation is, I think, is that John wants us to intentionally and consciously address our disgust response. I was just listening to a podcast about disgust. If you listen to the podcast Hidden Brain, you may have heard this recently. It turns out there are scientists who study disgust. They study what seems to be the reflexive human responses to things like rotted food and foul odors and excrement, or the idea of eating human flesh and drinking human blood. But their scientists have learned that in some cases, the things that disgust us are actually culturally conditioned. For instance, we in our culture have a strong reaction to the idea of drinking even animal blood, let alone human blood, but some cultures do, in some circumstances, consume animal blood. The Maasai in Africa and other hunter-gatherers and nomadic groups, groups that have a strong reliance on a particular animal for their survival, may very well, in certain situations, drink the blood of that animal. Most of us would be disgusted by this, but it's not an instinctual disgust, it is a learned disgust. It is culturally conditioned. Further, disgust can be used to manipulate us to feel a certain way about a person or a group of people. In fact, it's a powerful tool for vilifying people. When Trump in the 2024 debates repeated the lie that Haitian immigrants were eating people's pets, he was trying to trigger people's disgust response. Because it turns out that it's easy to plant in a person's mind a connection between something disgusting and a person or a group of people. Whether we invite that implantation or not, it's just a powerful connection that happens when we hear of something disgusting and we match it with a person, something gets stuck in our brain about that. And once that idea is implanted, it's very difficult for people to transcend that. Think about the way marginalized groups throughout history are so often called dirty. Think about how during segregation, white people would not even swim in a pool if a black person had been in the water. Think about how disgust is used in so much of the messaging against transgender people. There are people who have never met a transgender person in their life, but who have been conditioned by society to connect transgender with disgust. Because patriarchy depends on the gender binary for its existence, and it uses disgust as an enforcement tool. So what if Jesus is using disgust here in kind of the opposite way? What if Jesus with these teachings is saying, if you believe in me, if you want to be my followers, you have to transcend your disgust responses. You have to overcome your conditioning of biases and prejudices against people of other genders and people of other classes and people of other religions. And since so many of those biases are controlled by our conditioned disgust response, what Jesus says here is, I'm going to frame what it means to be my followers in the most disgusting way I can. If you want to be my followers, if you want to participate in a community based in my name, you have to be able to rise above your socially conditioned prejudices and biases. And that is a challenge. And some people, we are told in the story, couldn't handle it. They stopped following Jesus. But what it doesn't say is further on in the Gospel of John, Jesus gives us a way to overcome our disgust response. And that is the way of love. Jerry Seinfeld does a great bit that connects love and disgust. He talks about the way when we love someone, we want to touch their hair. We want to smell their hair. We want to run our fingers through their hair. We want to bury our face in their hair. But if a single hair becomes detached from somebody's head and we find it on the wall of a shower, or God forbid, in our food, disgusting. Even if we know it's the same hair that we did just loved a minute ago, and the person said, because love changes things. Love overpowers disgust. In another way, just ask anyone who has changed a diaper, either on a baby or on a beloved adult. Love for someone is more powerful than our disgust response. So maybe it's no coincidence that it's in the Gospel of John, the only gospel that pushes this metaphor so far, is also the only gospel where Jesus washes his disciples' feet. Something that many of us would feel is disgusting. And after he does that, he tells his disciples, you also must wash each other's feet. And then that's the context where he gives us this commandment, that you love each other just as I have loved you, so you must love one another. Love is the path that Jesus gives us to overcome our socially conditioned responses to one another. So maybe that speaks to why John pushes this metaphor so far into the realm of disgust, but let's talk about the metaphor itself. We are invited to consume Jesus. Now, of course, few things in John are literal, so this must symbolize something. What does it symbolize? Well, he never says it directly, but I think it's pretty clear when he says, I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats this bread will live forever. And the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. I think it's pretty clear for those of us who know the rest of the story that he's referring here to his crucifixion by the empire. The bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh, my body, my blood, my life. The crucifixion of Jesus, it's important to remember, was a choice for Jesus. He made it based on his desire to be in solidarity with all who are oppressed by the empire. Jesus could have chosen not to be crucified. He could have chosen a different path. He could have stayed up in Galilee in the north country where he was beloved and people were thronging around him. But instead he went to the heart of the empire's power in the city of Jerusalem. He rode in on a procession that challenged the empire's authority. He turned over tables in the temple, which was a challenge to the religious authorities. When the disciples wanted him to take up arms, to protect him from arrest, he stopped them. When Pilate gave him multiple opportunities to avoid the death penalty, Jesus refused to renounce his identity as a child of God. Even as he knew that being true to himself and his people meant that the empire would be brutalizing his flesh, spilling his blood, and taking his life, he remained true to his convictions and to himself. The bread of his body and the drink of his blood that we are invited to consume is his lived example of refusing to bow to the empire, even when it meant he would be killed by the empire. So are we, as his followers, willing to embody those principles and have that same courage? Are we willing to let those values course through our veins and be enfleshed in our bodies? Are we willing to eat and drink and consume and digest what Jesus is serving us, his example, his life, his body, and his blood? Now, let me close with just a few words about the use of metaphor in general and what it does here. Spanish philosopher José Ortega y Gasset said, "The metaphor is probably the most fertile power that humans possess. What metaphor does is it wipes away dividing lines. We go around thinking that the earth is one thing and our bodies are something completely separate. We go around thinking that I am completely separate from you and you from me, and there are a thousand things that make us different. But metaphor pulls away the shroud of distinction that causes us to see each other as different. Metaphor washes away the chalk lines that we have drawn on the sidewalk of reality." James Baldwin uses metaphor in his famous quote about the Vietnam War, when he says, "Every bombed village is my hometown." The larger context of that quote is, no black man in chains in his own country and watching the many deaths occurring around him every day believes for a moment that America cares anything about freedom in Asia. My own condition as a black man in America tells me that what Americans really feel and really want and who they really are. And therefore, every bombed village is my hometown. And then Irish Indian poet Nikita Gill was inspired by Baldwin's quote, and she wrote this poem. "Every bombed village is my hometown. Every dead child is my child. Every grieving mother is my mother. Every crying father is my father. Every home turned to rubble is the home I grew up in. Every brother carrying the remains of his brother across borders is my brother. Every sister waiting for her sister to come home, but will never see her, is my sister. Every one of these people are ours, just like we are theirs. We belong to them, and they belong to us." Based on these words from Baldwin and Gill, it seems that the suffering caused by injustice has a way of revealing that the differences we imagine between one another are only illusions. In a crisis, there is no time to decide whose child is whose. When you are fleeing from your home and from people who are trying to kill you, You have no tolerance for the nuances of national borders. When a boot is on your neck and your neighbor's neck and their neighbor's neck, you have no need for the categories that divide you from your neighbor. In the midst of oppression, nuances fall by the wayside, and the only thing left is the stark reality that we are all human. So every bomb village is my hometown. Jesus, in these teachings, wipes away those lines that divide him from the oppressed. He wipes away the lines that between him and his followers. And while he's at it, he wipes away the lines between himself and the earth. The wheat of the bread, the grape of the vine, the sun and the rain are all one with him and with all of us. So John has Jesus say, "Eat my flesh and drink my blood." Does that gross you out? It's supposed to. If we can't face our disgust in just the idea of flesh and blood, how can we transcend the social conditioning that divides us from the real bodies that don't smell like us, or don't wear the same clothes, or don't have the same abilities? Or how do we even separate ourselves and see that we are one with all the people who are put in so many different categories? If we can't rise above our disgust and erase the lines that divide us, we can't be followers of Christ. So on the night of his arrest, the night before his torture and execution by the empire, Jesus gathered with his disciples for a last meal together, and he took bread and blessed it and broke it and said, "This is my body. This is my body broken for you. Take, eat, all of you, of my body." And he said, "This is cup is my blood." Drink it. This is my body. This is my blood. Every bomb village is my hometown. Every dead child is my child. Every grieving father is my father. Every crying mother is my mother. Every broken body is my body and your body. Every drop of spilled blood is my blood and your blood. When we follow the example of Christ to courageously stand by our convictions and our principles in the face of the power and the principalities of this present darkness, we become us. He becomes us, and we become him. When we follow the example of the early church and use love to transcend our biases and our conditioning and serve one another and wash one another's feet, we become the body and blood of Christ. These are the gifts of God for the people of God. I invite you to come forward. We'll form a circle, a large circle around the whole table up here.
Thanks for listening to sermons from First Presbyterian Church, Palo Alto, located at 1140 Cowper Street in Palo Alto, California. If you'd like to worship with us, we gather Sundays at 10 a.m., both in person and online. And you can find more information about our congregation, worship, and ministries at fpcpaloalto.org. We hope to see you soon.